same night. Chatterton arrived at O'Hare Airport on Wednesday, September 18th. Only 3 days remained until the seekers returned to the wreck site. He took a taxi to the Gargantuan Museum and followed signs inside to the U-boat. He stood in line alongside restless schoolchildren on field trips, vaguely interested retirees, and a few military buffs. Then he calculated how many times he might repeat this tour before his return flight to New Jersey. Chapter 4. John Chatterton. In ways, it amazed Chatterton that he was still alive to visit museums. He had lived a life of startling decisions, many of which he'd known could kill him, and all of which would have been unfathomable to the tourists with whom he stood in line. Now that he was 40 years old, married, and ideally employed, his past sometimes seemed to belong to someone else. Still, in unexpected places, like this museum, small things hurtled him back in time. Drab gray paint on a waiting area display evoked 1970, a year that still lived hot in his bloodstream. Photos of a giant ocean hung on nearby walls tossed him onto the waters of an unlikely boyhood. Today he might have looked like everyone else standing beside him, but none of them had come close to a life like his. That life began on a leafy September in 1951, when Jack and Patricia Chatterton welcomed their first child into their lives. The scene was 1950s perfect. Jack was a Yale-educated, up-and-coming aerospace engineer for the Sperry Company, a fantastical-sounding job in an era when the word aerospace conjured images of Martians and death rays. Patricia was a 24-year-old, newly retired fashion model who had twirled her willowy shape and waterfall brown hair on international runways. When John was 3, his family moved to a new ranch-style home in Garden City, a Tony Long Island suburb populated by Manhattan executives, local business owners, and jockey Eddie Arcaro. Few could imagine a better place to raise a child. Garden City was safe and quiet, its tracked homes and color televisions promising Americans a new and better way of living. When John was 4, Patricia gave birth to another son, McRae, named for Patricia's father. As the boys grew into school age, Garden City's fortunes grew with them. 4 Long Island railroad stations served the town in a time when most communities were lucky to get one. The Chattertons enjoyed a large TV and electric heat. John's bicycle had training wheels that didn't squeak. Patricia made the beach her priority. She drove her 2 boys 40 minutes to Gilgo Beach, along a stretch of barrier islands off the south shore of Long Island. There she turned John and McRae loose to run like untied balloons, their bare feet on fire against the blazing sand, until they had to rush into the Atlantic for relief. John's father never joined the family there. He was busy. He didn't like sand and salt water. It was the salt water that gave John his feeling. At home he was thrilled by little. School was okay. Books were so-so. Mickey Mantle was all right. But when he stood in the Atlantic up to his knees and looked out over the horizon, he felt as if he could see a different world, a world that no one talked about. At home he would push his T-shirts against his face and smell the salt water, and that also gave John his feeling. At home, John's life was different from those of his friends. His mother spoke to him without filters, expressing viewpoints without dumbing down her ideas or dialogue. John's father liked to have fun, but not the ball-tossing, fishing-trip recreation that television fathers favored. Jack would spend hours behind his desk at home, studying aerospace equations and smoking through his daily 4-packs of Kents. 2 martinis, and he was ready to put on a gorilla mask and run around the neighborhood. When Jack began to drink heavily, Patricia tried to coax him into becoming a proper father. He countered by upping his working, smoking, and drinking. Patricia decided then that as long as her own father was still alive, she was going to leave Jack out of things. Patricia's father was Ray Emmett Arison, a retired Rear Admiral and Navy hero who had commanded submarines for 10 years in the 1930s and led battleships in World War II. To Patricia, who had idolized her father since girlhood, there was no better model of courage, decency, and immersion in life than Admiral Arison. He had since moved to South Carolina, near the beach. She arranged visits and began a campaign to steep her boys in her father's example. She told her sons of her father's love of submarines, about how each man depended on every other for his life, so that the greenest enlisted man had been as responsible for the survival of the submarine as had her father. And she told them that her father found honor in this idea. Occasionally she told stories of Admiral Arison's battles in the Pacific during World War II. But mostly she told the boys about how her father had distinguished himself as a man. She told them that after the war, her father had hobbled on crutches across America to visit the families of every man who had perished under his command, because it was the right thing to do, that he needed to tell them in person that he appreciated their sons. She also told them that her father had helped the families of enlisted men with money and encouragement. She told them, sometimes daily, that her father valued excellence and persistence above all, and that life could be unlimited for a man who aimed high and never gave up. In third grade, John played the brave prince in a school play. He wasn't the star. That was Prince Charming. He didn't get the girl. That was also for Prince Charming. He got killed in the final act. But he loved the role. As opening night approached, he found himself thinking, "I really am like the brave prince. I'm not handsome like Prince Charming. Girls don't really like me. But if I have one special thing, it's courage. Being the brave prince is better than being Prince Charming because I get to have courage." As John turned 10, his parents argued constantly. He played harder at the beach and developed a dry sense of humor and a deep belly laugh that stopped even adults. "Your kid is like one of us," friends told Patricia. That summer, some neighbors allowed John to try their simple scuba setup. The tank was buoyant, so the boy could only float. But his head was in the water, and he was breathing. Breathing inside water. And he could see rays of sunlight beaming through the water and pointing to the bottom. And he wanted desperately to go down because he couldn't see far enough. But the neighbors had said no diving. So he thought very hard while he breathed inside water. He thought, "If I could get down there, that is where it's happening." One summer day when John was 12, he and his friend Rob DeNigris hitchhiked a ride out of Garden City, an adventure still considered safe in 1963 America. They got 50 miles from home, to a rural outpost in Suffolk County. John and Rob began walking down a country road, looking for whatever neat stuff was supposed to be on country roads. They came upon an old Victorian-style house. The place appeared abandoned. The grounds were overgrown in weeds, loping tree branches veiled shuttered windows, and the inside looked dark and still, as if sunlight had stopped bothering. The boys approached slowly. They had seen enough horror films to know better, yet each believed there to be stories inside. They tried a door. It opened. Upstairs they found piles of decades-old newspapers, still unfolded, and they sat on splintery crates and read the stories aloud to each other, tales of strange people from another time who had concerns that didn't entirely make sense today. In the basement, John discovered jars of preserved fruit. It had to be a few years' supply. And he was struck by the optimism of these jars, that the people who'd lived here had hoped to be around for a long time, that they had expected to enjoy eating something sweet in the future. The boys passed hours in the house. Neither considered hurting the place or disturbing its belongings. As dusk fell, they replaced their discoveries, even the newspapers, in the way they had found them. As the boys hitchhiked home, they constructed scenarios to explain the house and its tenants. The preserves indicated the presence of a woman. The windows had not been boarded up because the tenants had left unexpectedly. The newspapers might have been left by a relative years after the last people lived there. Time disappeared while they made these theories. They tried to hitchhike back to the house a few days later, but could not explain to the person who picked them up exactly where they had been. The boys walked a country road, but came up empty. They tried again the next day and the next. Each time, they failed to find the house. They desperately wanted to go back. They tried a half dozen times. They drew maps, but they could never find it. They never knew where they had been. The boys hitchhiked a lot after that, but they never found a place that great again. John entered Garden City High School in 1965, the year the first Marines landed at Da Nang. He had grown into some of his tallness, and with his short blonde hair and squaring jaw, looked every week more man than kid. He made friends easily, especially among guys who appreciated his wild side, a side that could hitchhike 50 miles or rebuild a motorcycle's suicide shifter. John's academic averageness continued in high school. But a sophomore year unfolded, he began to get a handle on impressions that had been just vague companions since grade school. Garden City was isolated, he thought, enveloped by a protective bubble that shielded residents from all that was going on in the rest of the world. People's concerns seemed small. They worried about who owned the best vacation house, or whether Dad would pop for the auxiliary air spring kit for their new Mustang. Neighbors claimed to favor civil rights and even went out of their way to invoke the positives of having a black boy in the high school. But there were no minorities or working-class folks living in Garden City. As John became an upperclassman, he continued his love affair with the beach. Still, he never dreamed of becoming a world-class fisherman or a champion surfer or the next Jacques Cousteau. Aside from his grandfather, he had no heroes. He didn't even have a nickname, a fact that he believed kind of summed it up about him in high school. But he always thought big about the ocean. Every time he looked at the Atlantic, he marveled at the vastness of the world that must lie beyond Garden City. In 1968, John's junior year, reports poured in about unthinkable war casualties all around Vietnam. Everyone had an opinion, and John listened to all of them. But the more John absorbed these viewpoints, the more he suspected that these people didn't really know. It was not that he doubted their conviction. In fact, he admired their passion and felt invigorated by the era. But he asked himself about the lives of the people behind the opinions. And the more he asked, the more he became convinced that few of them had ever gone out and looked for themselves. By this time, John's parents had divorced, and his father had moved to California. One evening, John's father called home and asked his son about his future. John knew what his dad wanted to hear, that he would apply to Yale and then pursue a field worthy of the mind. Instead, John found strange words pouring out of his mouth. He told his father that he intended to explore the world, not as a tourist or an intellectual, but in search of answers. He told his father he didn't know where he was going, just that he had to go, that he had to see for himself. "The hell you are!" his father exploded. Jack had started his own business and had just invented the circuitry for the bar-o-matic, the device that allows bartenders to pour several sodas from a single hose. He was riding high. He had money. John would come work for him. "That's your plan. That's not my plan," John said. "If you don't do it, John, you will end up a common laborer." John hung up the phone. Early in 1969, during John's final semester of high school, a girl attended one of his classes wearing a black armband. B-52 bombers had conducted recent heavy raids against targets near the Cambodian border. American protesters were demanding that the United States leave Vietnam. The girl made strong statements that day. She believed in her anti-war message. John pictured himself as a soldier risking his life in combat, and wondered whether he would appreciate this girl and her armband and her fist. But he could not decide. He did not have enough information. And this was John's central problem in life, right there in the classroom, right next to the girl with the armband, and students chanting, "Right on!" He didn't have answers. He had never gone and seen for himself. John hit on an idea. The military could take him into the world. By joining the military, he could see for himself. He asked himself if he could kill a person or fight for a cause he might come to despise. Again, he had no good answer. Then he had an epiphany. He could volunteer as a medic. No matter how ugly things got, as a medic he could help people instead of killing people. He could stay positive and still have a first-person experience with the most important questions in the world. He first considered the Navy, his grandfather's branch. But the Navy made provisions for the grandchildren of heroes, and John wanted no special treatment. Other branches would not guarantee a specialty. Only the Army promised to make a volunteer a medic in return for a 4-year commitment. John enlisted. In January 1970, the Army assigned Private Chatterton to the neurosurgical ward of the 249th General Hospital in Osaka, Japan. He was 18. The ward existed for a single purpose: to treat the horrors of war. Every day, wounded American soldiers arrived in waves as if coming over a hill, some missing the backs of their skulls, others with torn spines, still others delirious or screaming for mother, or with sideways faces. Chatterton bathed patients, applied their dressings, turned them in bed as they tried to recover from damage done by ingeniously cruel weapons. Many of the patients were Chatterton's age. Sometimes a soldier would look at him before surgery and say, "I'm paralyzed, man." On the ward, Chatterton might let his mind wander for a moment and try to fathom life for a man suddenly without his body at 18. If a soldier had it good in 1970, that soldier was Chatterton. He rode trains and drank beer and dined often in Osaka's sukiyaki houses. He liked his work. It was emotional and important. He was seeing the world. He was out of harm's way. But as he watched the parade of ruined lives delivered to the neuro ward, he began to ask questions that would not go away. What caused people to do this to one another? How is this happening to these guys? What is going on over that hill? Chatterton studied the wounded. Mostly he watched their eyes as doctors explained about wheelchairs and breathing tubes. And their eyes always seemed to stare straight ahead, as if the men were looking through the doctor. To Chatterton, these soldiers were not charge of the light brigade types. They looked stunned, afraid, lonely. But they also looked like they knew something Chatterton did not know. As months passed and busloads of neurosurgical patients poured through the 249th, Chatterton's questions grew more urgent. He devoured newspapers, read books, and sought out conversations. But those sources only told him about politics. They couldn't explain how the world could have come to this. He got the feeling again, the same one he'd had on the beach as a boy, that he would have to go see for himself. Chatterton began telling friends that he might request a transfer to Vietnam. Their response was immediate and unanimous. "Are you fucking crazy?" He tested the idea on his superiors. They pleaded with him to reconsider, and explained that neurosurgical ward duty was among a soldier's highest callings. He told them that this was not about patriotism or anything noble like that. He just needed to understand. Even the wounded pleaded with Chatterton. "Don't go, man. It's a big mistake," they said. A paralyzed soldier told him, "Stay here, do your time, and go home. I'm wasted, but you're still good, and you gotta stay good." But Chatterton requested the transfer. In June 1970, he was on an airplane to Chu Lai in South Vietnam. Chatterton was assigned to the 4th Battalion, 31st Infantry, of the AmeriCal Division. When he landed, he was told to report to the battalion aid station on a fire base near the Laotian border, a place called LZ West. He reached the fire base late that morning. Around noon, a telephone rang on the base. A man answered, said nothing for a moment, then mumbled, "Shit," into the receiver. Soon everyone on the base began scrambling. An administrative officer called to Chatterton. "Get your gear. A medic in the field just got killed getting off a helicopter. You're taking his place." Chatterton wasn't sure if he heard the guy correctly. He was replacing a dead medic? On a helicopter? In the field? Then the same man began to sob and his eyes went wild. A look Chatterton had seen on those suffering nervous breakdowns in the Japanese hospital. Chatterton stood in place as men grabbed weapons and gear and zigzagged around him. He did not know where to go or what to do. A minute later, a smallish man with scruffy brown hair grabbed his arm and told him, "Listen, I'm a medic too. I'll get you ready to go out there." The medic looked old, at least 24. He introduced himself as Mouse. "Follow me," Mouse said. Mouse led Chatterton to a bunker on the firebase. It would be a few hours before the helicopter arrived to take Chatterton into the jungle. Until then, Mouse said he would show Chatterton the ropes. "If you want, man, we can talk while we work," he said. In the bunker, Mouse stuffed Chatterton's aid bag with the field medic's tools. Malaria pills, tetracycline, morphine, IV, tape, scissors, field dressings, and explained the jungle way to use them all, unhappy methods more sudden than Chatterton had learned in the hospital. In between, he spoke to Chatterton of Vietnam. "I hate the war," Mouse said, "but I'm here. I do everything I can for the men. I'm here to be a good medic. The war is irrelevant to me. Over here, being a good medic is my life." Mouse labeled the malaria and dysentery pills, pulled buckles around Chatterton's gear, and told him to carry a small aid bag in addition to the larger one thought sufficient by average medics. On patrol, he told Chatterton, "A great medic separates his trauma supplies from the allergy and stomach cramp shit. You don't lug antihistamines to treat a bullet wound to the head." "These guys are your responsibility," Mouse continued. "For me, I have to do right by my men. That's the only thing that matters, the men. They're the only thing." Chatterton asked Mouse about the .45-caliber pistol he kept on his hip. Didn't field medics arm themselves better than that? "A lot of medics carry a rifle or machine gun," Mouse said. "The only reason I carry a weapon at all is to protect a guy who's down. I'm not willing to let the enemy finish a guy I'm treating just because I'm unarmed. But I won't carry an offensive weapon. I'm no warrior. I leave the heavy stuff behind. It's symbolic in a way. It reminds me why I'm here." For the next 2 hours, Chatterton lost himself in Mouse's philosophy. Mouse had ideas about courage and dedication and conviction that Chatterton had known were true, but could never enunciate. For those 2 hours, Chatterton forgot that his life would be on the line that day. A helicopter arrived. Someone shouted, "Let's go!" Mouse helped stuff hand grenades and a poncho into Chatterton's pack, then quizzed him a final time on which pill treated which ailment. Chatterton grabbed his helmet. He strapped a 45 caliber pistol to his hip. "One more thing," Mouse said. "A lot of the stuff you do out there, you're going to have to live with all the way down the line. You have to make decisions out there. When that happens, you have to ask yourself, where do I want to be in 10 years, 20 years? How will I want to feel about this decision when I'm an old man?" That's the question for making important decisions. Chatterton nodded and shook Mouse's hand. Mouse would remain at the base. Chatterton wondered if he would see this man again. He could only think to say, "Thanks a lot, Mouse. Goodbye." Then he climbed into the chopper and sat on a case of sea rations. No seats, no seat belts. And the machine lifted away, disappearing above the trees and into the sun on its way to the real Vietnam. The helicopter released Chatterton and several boxes of supplies in the jungle, then disappeared back into the sky. For what seemed an eternity, there was no one else there. Finally, Chatterton heard rustling behind a patch of trees. He turned toward the sound to see a dozen men emerging from the jungle, Western men with filthy faces, long hair, and scraggly beards. To Chatterton, it appeared as if a California motorcycle gang had materialized in Vietnam. The men walked toward him dressed in torn olive T-shirts and shredded pants. None wore a helmet or flak jacket or other military garb. As they came nearer, it seemed to Chatterton that each soldier carried the same expression, the look of a man who could no longer be surprised. The soldiers broke open the supply boxes and began to outfit themselves. None said a word to Chatterton, including another medic assigned to the company command post. Every so often, one of them would glance up at Chatterton with a tired disgust that was an unmistakable subtitle in Vietnam. "You don't know shit. You won't be around long. If we need help, you probably won't deliver." As the men finished packing, one of them grunted to Chatterton, "Let's go." The men made up a small platoon. They were on the move to a new location. While in transit, they were to hunt and kill North Vietnamese as necessary. The group walked into the jungle. Chatterton walked with them in the single-file line. The men crossed rice paddies, swatted bird-sized insects, slogged through alligator-infested rivers, stepped over a machine-gunned buffalo. An hour into the jungle, shots rang out. The platoon hit the ground. Chatterton was the last man down. Bullets polka-dotted the dirt around them. Chatterton believed his heart was going to explode. When the shooting stopped, he looked around. The expressions on the faces around him had remained exactly as they were when he'd first seen them. Minutes later, the men resumed walking. Chatterton pulled himself together and joined them. When his breath returned and his brain began working again, he thought to himself, "These guys are crazed killers. Nobody is talking to me. Where the hell am I? What have I done?" The platoon spent the evening under a sweltering moon. While the others slept, Chatterton lay awake. At dawn, he saw a tiger disappear into the jungle. The next day, as the temperature broke 100 degrees, the platoon arrived on the outskirts of an abandoned village. Reports indicated enemy soldiers in the vicinity. Other than Chatterton, the men in the platoon were heavily armed and primed for such a confrontation, none more so than John Ace Lacko, a 28-year-old New Jersey paper hanger whom Chatterton had pegged as the platoon's top dog. Lacko, 6'2" and 220 pounds, was completing his third tour, an old-timer by Vietnam standards. He carried an M60 machine gun with 700 rounds crisscrossed on assault straps slung over his chest. the era's definition of locked and loaded. Lacko had earned the nickname Ace for the black playing card he was said to leave on the chests of the enemies he had killed. The platoon walked single file as they began the patrol. Before long, they came to a dried-up rice paddy that looked to provide easy passage through the otherwise hilly terrain. They entered the open area, scanning the hillside for the enemy. About 50 yards into the clearing, Lacko stepped up onto a rock to get a better view of the surroundings. Shots rang out from a hillside forward left. 5 rounds, two of them armor-piercing, tore through Lacko's left hip and traveled clear through to his right hip. Stunned, he placed his gear on the ground and lay down, partially camouflaging himself in the 2-foot grass. Blood began flowing from his wounds. The rest of the platoon turned back and took cover behind a 10-foot pile of dirt and rocks back near the opening to the field. Someone yelled, "Ace is hit! Medic! Medic!" Chatterton and the other medic crawled forward. They could see Lacko's outline in the grass about 50 yards away. He was in the open, a clear target. The enemy would not finish him. They were likely waiting for a medic to run out, giving them 2 kills for the price of 1. The platoon's other medic, Chatterton's superior, hugged close to the protective cover made by the wall of dirt. "Fuck it, I'm not going out there," he told Chatterton. The platoon could only glare at the man. As for Chatterton, they expected him to do even less. No greenhorn on his 2nd day in Vietnam was going to run onto a shooting range. "I'll get him," Chatterton said. The platoon went silent. No one was more surprised than Chatterton. He began to remove his gear, all except for the small aid bag Mouse had packed for him. "Christ, the kid's gonna go," someone said. The platoon began to take position to provide cover fire. With each moment, Chatterton's vision narrowed and the jungle sounds compressed, until the only impressions in his world were his own heaving breaths and pounding heart. Chatterton had contemplated moments like this at the hospital in Japan. He believed that if he was ever faced with such a decision, he could call upon the lessons of his grandfather. Now, as he readied himself to make the naked run to Lacko, he thought to himself, "I'm going to find out what I am." Chatterton sprinted into the open. A barrage of gunfire rang from the hillside far left. Bullets sprayed dirt around Chatterton, but he kept running. Halfway to his man, he could see Lacko lying in the grass. He ran faster. The ground in front of him staccatoed with gunfire. Behind him, he could hear his platoon returning fire so thick that the sky itself began to explode. Chatterton expected to be killed. He kept waiting to fall. But a blur of a feeling kept him from turning back. And that feeling was that he did not want to go through life knowing that he had given up. A second later, he slid into the grass next to Lacko. "I was laying there and the numbness and shock were setting in," Lacko recalls today. "And I see this new guy. Here comes this new guy, and he's coming with everything he's got. I didn't know him at all. Didn't even know his name. But he put himself right in the line of fire. The guy was risking his life." Chatterton took cover in the grass beside Lacko. Bullets tore up the ground around them. Chatterton reached into his supply bag for scissors, slit Lacko's pants top to bottom, and looked for arterial damage. There was none. Lacko could be moved immediately. Now Chatterton had to get him back to the protection of the dirt wall, a distance of 50 yards that seemed to stretch across all Vietnam. Chatterton considered throwing Lacko over his shoulders, but the wounded soldier outweighed him by 50 pounds. Chatterton sat on the ground behind Lacko and took his arms. More shots hit the dirt where they lay. Chatterton began pushing his legs backward in order to drag Lacko backward a body length at a time, all the while waiting for a bullet to strike him. 2 minutes later, they were halfway to the dirt wall. By now the platoon had pinpointed the source of the enemy fire and was beating back the attack on Chatterton and Lacko. Soon the men were 10 feet from the wall, then 5 feet, then behind it. Soldiers rushed to them. Moments later, two American Cobra attack helicopters swooped in and unleashed hellfire on the enemy hillside. A Huey medevac chopper followed the Cobras in and airlifted Lacko, now in shock, to the hospital. As the Huey disappeared, Chatterton collapsed to the ground. He was dehydrated and exhausted. He scarcely knew where he was. But he could see that something had changed in the men. They spoke to him. They rubbed his shoulders. They smiled at him. They called him Doc. As the platoon moved through the jungle, some of the soldiers might have wondered about the shelf life of Chatterton's courage. American medics in Vietnam walked in uniquely dangerous boots when they accompanied a squad on combat patrol. Because their job was to aid wounded soldiers, medics often found themselves running directly to where the action was hottest, around landmines, in the line of sniper fire, and over booby traps. But the medic faced an even more insidious risk. The enemy often wanted him dead more than anyone. Killing a squad's medic meant that the soldiers would be on their own when wounded, a devastating blow to a squad's morale. In the days following Lacko's shooting, Chatterton volunteered for every patrol available to the platoon. The men chuckled and clapped him on the back, and explained that a medic who walked every patrol would be pulling an impossible and deadly load. Something was rumbling inside Chatterton. He had been excellent on his first patrol, and the feeling of success was overwhelming to him. He could not imagine turning away from the first thing in his life at which he had been special, the thing at which he might be great. Every day for the next 2 weeks, Chatterton walked patrol with his platoon. Every day the men took fire. Chatterton always went to get the wounded guy. And he always went the same way. While most medics picked and crawled along the dirt to minimize their profiles, Chatterton just up and hauled ass, all 6'2" of him, to hell with enemy gunfire. Soon enough, Doc had developed a reputation more important than any medal or honor could confer. Doc, the men said, was a crazy motherfucker. Chatterton had been with the platoon for about 2 weeks when word came down. Mouse had been killed. His squad had taken prisoners, and Mouse had been asked to watch the captives. An enemy sniper crept up on the location and looked for a target. He might have chosen one of several Americans in range. But Mouse, carrying his .45-caliber pistol, appeared different from the rest. To the enemy, he likely appeared as an officer. The sniper lined up Mouse in his sights and pulled the trigger, hitting the medic several times. If Chatterton had retained any illusion about Vietnam, such folly vaporized with Mouse's killing. He traded in his .45 pistol for an M16 rifle. He had come to Vietnam looking for answers about America and about mankind. And suddenly those answers seemed obvious. America was wrong to be in Vietnam. Men killed one another because they are animals. So he had his answers. Big fucking deal. Yet Chatterton still found himself volunteering for every patrol and running for every wounded guy. And when he sat against trees to catch his breath, he marveled at how full life felt when a person got to be excellent. And he began to wonder if he might have come to Vietnam to answer questions of a different kind. "People talked about this kid Chatterton," says Dr. Norman Sakai, the battalion surgeon. "I hadn't met him yet. But the first thing you heard about him was that he walked point. That seemed unbelievable to me. Medics weren't supposed to engage in war. Even going on patrol was stretching it for a medic. But walking point? You never heard of a medic walking point. I thought maybe this guy was crazy." But people said no, he was different. People talked about him all the time. As weeks turned to months, and Chatterton continued to distinguish himself, he studied himself and others in action, watched soldiers live and die, and show courage and break down, paid careful attention to the behavior of men around him, all to divine further insight into the right way to live. Gradually he distilled certain principles that seemed to him indisputable truths, and he collected these principles like so many medicines in the aid-pack of his mind. As he neared the end of his 6-month field obligation, he had come to believe these things. If an undertaking was easy, someone else already would have done it. If you follow in another's footsteps, you miss the problems really worth solving. Excellence is born of preparation, dedication, focus, and tenacity. Compromise on any of these, and you become average. Every so often, life presents a great moment of decision, an intersection at which a man must decide to stop or go. A person lives with these decisions forever. Examine everything. Not all is as it seems or as people tell you. It is easiest to live with a decision if it is based on an earnest sense of right and wrong. The guy who gets killed is often the guy who got nervous. The guy who doesn't care anymore, who has said, "I'm already dead. The fact that I live or die is irrelevant, and the only thing that matters is the accounting I give of myself," is the most formidable force in the world. The worst possible decision is to give up. For 4 months, Chatterton thought about the right way and the wrong way to live, and he continued to contemplate his principles. As one patrol bled into another and men died, his thinking solidified, and he began to consider that it might have been for these insights that he had come to Vietnam. But when he had looked into forever over the Atlantic as a child, and felt sure that there was more on the other side, it was these ideas that were calling him, ideas about how a man should live. In June 1971, after completing his 12-month tour, Chatterton returned home to begin a 2-week leave before returning to Vietnam for a voluntary 6-month extension. His mother was stunned at the sight of him. Her son would not sit in a chair or sleep on a bed, but would only exist on the floor. He ate off a cocktail table while sitting cross-legged on the ground. When she asked him to speak, he said nothing for a while, then sobbed and told her about men missing the backs of their heads and screaming for their mothers, about starving, about the first time he'd killed someone, about seeing the worst things a person could see. He would go quiet again after that. His mother picked up the phone and called a family friend with military clout. Chatterton never made it back to Vietnam. He was reassigned to the dispensary at Fort Hamilton in Brooklyn, and developed a bad attitude. The Army referred him to a psychiatrist, where he pretended to be what they wanted him to be, until they certified him as healthy. He married a girl he knew from high school, realized it was a mistake, and had the marriage annulled a few months later. Such was his routine for 2 years, punching the clock, feeling angry and confused, wondering about his future, until he had completed his 4-year obligation to the Army. Then Chatterton decided to leave everything. Chatterton spent the years from 1973 to 1978 trying to find a niche. He lived in Florida, where he tried hospital work and attended college. After his father died of a heart attack in 1976 at age 48, he moved to New Jersey and started a small construction business in the resort town of Cape May. None of this work afforded him the feeling of excellence he had realized in Vietnam, a feeling missing from his life since he'd returned to the States. In the spring of 1978, Chatterton walked to the Cape May docks and approached an acquaintance for a job on a local scallop fishing boat. A day later, he was at sea. The man explained the business. The boat dragged 2 10-foot-wide steel dredges along the ocean floor. Every half hour, the dredges would be hauled up and the contents of their attached bags emptied onto the deck. The crew would dig through the buffet of things that lived in the ocean, pull the scallops out, and throw the remaining junk overboard. Then the men would take the scallops into the cutting house and shuck them. When Chatterton asked which of these jobs would be his, the men replied, "All of them." Chatterton took to scallop fishing from the start. He learned to cut and weld steel, tie knots, splice cable. In short, to do whatever it took, an instinct that resonated inside him. He ate like a king from scruffy-bearded cooks who knew scallops and lobster more intimately than chefs at five-star Parisian restaurants. But the part that moved him was watching the ocean floor come to life on the deck. The massive dredges did not discriminate in what they pulled from the bottom of the Atlantic. Along with piles of scallops came Russian fishing nets, whale skulls, bombs, cannonballs, mastodon teeth, muskets, and shipwreck artifacts. Lots of shipwreck artifacts. The other crewmen viewed such artifacts as garbage. To them, scallops equaled money. Everything else equaled shit that you kicked over the side. To Chatterton, the everything else was the only thing. The boat captain paid Chatterton $3,000 and a 10-pound bag of scallops for the 9-day trip, a king's ransom in 1978. Better, Chatterton now had a place on the boat. He made several more trips that year, some lucrative, others a flop, none without a treasure chest of ocean artifacts to coax his mind into scenarios. He began to tote home items until his place looked like a B-movie pirate ship. His television atop a lobster trap, a whale skull on the wall, whale bones on the roof, a Russian fishing net strung across the ceiling and booby-trapped to fall on visitors as they entered through the front door. For 2 years, Chatterton earned a handsome living and learned the sea as a scallop fisherman. He often vowed to go scuba diving, but his intense and unpredictable work schedule prevented it. Chatterton promised himself that when things lightened up, he would strap on the tanks and really see the ocean. In 1980, flush from another successful scallop run, Chatterton met Kathy Castor, a co-owner of a tiny dockside restaurant in Cape May. He knew he was interested in Kathy before they finished their first drink. While many women Chatterton knew had locked onto safe and predictable paths, Kathy's life had been creative and open-ended. She had grown up in nearby Atlantic City, but had fled to test the California life after graduating from high school. She wore peasant dresses, a sheepskin coat, Stevie Nicks blonde hair, and One Day at a Time cool. When people talked about Woodstock, she told them she had not only attended the festival, but had lived in the town, too. Chatterton loved her pragmatism, perhaps most of all. Kathy did not go in for the girly activities typical of many women he knew. She disliked beauty shops and thought shopping boring. She preferred active sports and the outdoors, and respected that Chatterton made his living on the seas, with his hands. And Kathy did not seem frightened by him. He was 29 years old, but had no college plans. He went to sea for weeks at a time in terrible storms. He was nowhere close to finding himself. Castor respected these qualities. When Chatterton told her he wasn't sure where he was going in life, she told him she believed in him. Kathy and Chatterton moved in together. He bought her a .380 pistol to keep in the home for protection while he was out at sea. At the shooting range, he admired her facility with a gun. She had never fired a weapon before, but the bullseyes on the targets kept exploding. This was his kind of girl. Neither seemed in any hurry to marry or have children, and the union felt relaxed and open-ended. If a woman can put up with these whale bones, Chatterton thought, I think she can put up with me. The couple had lived together for less than a year when, in 1981, the bottom fell out of the scallop market, and Chatterton's earnings plummeted. Kathy's restaurant had closed, leaving the couple financially strained. Chatterton signed up for a grueling 17-day trip. When the captain wrote him a check for $85 at the end, he knew it was time to quit the scallop business. At home, he and Kathy discussed the future. His GI Bill benefits expired in a year, in 1983. So if he intended to go back to school, he needed to do it now. Chatterton found computers fascinating and figured them to be the future. He enrolled in a programming course and was given a starting date. On the eve of the first class, Chatterton awoke from his sleep and sat bolt upright in bed. He shook Kathy until she awakened. She thought he was having a nightmare or a Vietnam flashback. She grabbed him without turning on the lights. "Kathy, Kathy, Kathy!"
"John, what's wrong?"
"I can't become a computer programmer."
"What are you saying?"
"I can't spend my life sitting under fluorescent lights."
"Okay. Okay. You have to be happy, John."
"I know what I'm going to do now. I'm going to be a commercial diver."
"What's that?"
"I don't exactly know. I don't know yet, but it just feels right to me. A commercial diver." He fell back to sleep, content. Chatterton did not know what commercial divers did or where they worked. But he felt like the clouds had parted and the rays were coming down. The next day he rushed out to buy an issue of Skin Diver magazine. Inside were ads for commercial diving schools. Now the idea seemed perfect. He had experience in carpentry, steelworking, respiratory medicine, and diving. He was a natural in the water. A school in Camden offered classes. 2 months later, he drove his purple gremlin to that school to pursue his new dream. Chatterton had been in class just a few minutes before he concluded that commercial diving was indeed his calling. The instructor said commercial divers made a career of one-of-a-kind jobs, improvising and solving problems on the spot, working in hostile and rapidly changing environments. Chatterton could barely sit still. This was the setup under which he remembered being great in Vietnam. He took to the muscular tools of the trade. The 25-pound Desco pot helmet made of spun copper. The air hoses that connected the diver to topside air generators. The thick neoprene gloves. The dry suit. All of it felt like a second skin. As the 4-month course wore on, Chatterton wondered how he had ever gone so long without knowing a man could get paid for diving. After graduation, Chatterton signed on with a commercial diving outfit that worked in New York Harbor. In his first month, he made perhaps 50 dives, each unique in its setting and challenge. In a single week, he might be asked to demolish underwater concrete, or install experimental pile wrap at the Port Authority heliport, or weld a rusted support beam under South Street. Every time he told his bosses, "I can do it." Chatterton faced immense problems in the waters beneath Manhattan. He often worked in zero visibility, in tunnels or caves, or under structures so dense in silt and sediment that he could not see his own glove pressed against his face mask. He was asked to pretzel himself into inhuman spaces, then do detailed work inside. His thick neoprene gloves short-circuited his tactile sense. In winter, his dry suit became saran wrap in the freezing New York Harbor waters. Overnight tides worked like vandals to undo his daily progress. At home, Chatterton told Kathy, "This job was made for me." He felt centered in the water, relaxed when straight-jacketed between steel beams, at peace even without his eyes. He volunteered for everything, an act that felt like an old friend. Chatterton liked to challenge himself. On days when the visibility dropped to zero, he pressed his body against the crevices of his surroundings assembling impressions from elbows, knees, neck, even fins, until the work site came to life like a painting in his imagination. He made hands of his every body part, at once placing, say, a left calf against a wall for orientation, a right knee atop an important set of wrenches, and a boot outside a hole as a barometer for changes in current. As he spent more time in the water, his sense of touch heightened to such a pitch that he could distinguish ordinary steel from burn steel solely by the different vibrations each made against his knife. Often he needed only brush an ankle or a weight belt against an object to deduce that object's identity and condition. Chatterton's independence from eyesight freed his imagination. He began to visualize storylines for his dives, imagining how a shackle would fall if it slipped his grip, how he might reorient himself in a tunnel should a support beam crack, how he could slither out a cave's crack if the front end collapsed. Over the next year, he came to believe that he could see with his mind and body as sharply as he could with his eyes, and this granted him an unteachable calm. When things went wrong in the water, even in total darkness or a crescendoing chaos, he didn't panic, because he believed he could see. Soon he was negotiating the tightest and most dangerous spaces in the commercial diving business, feeling with his body, feeling with his equipment, feeling with his tools, confident that he was safe so long as those paintings kept showing in his mind. Topside crews began to call Chatterton a natural. In good visibility, he watched everything. He studied the ways objects fell through water, the effect of current on sediment, the stages of metallic decomposition, the patterns in which water danced around man-made things, the orientation of wood chips as they became buried in sand. All of it was interesting to him. All of it, he believed, could be useful to him on future dives, even if he could not figure out how at the moment. He planned relentlessly. Driving to work, he rehearsed the movements of his dive the way a ballet dancer envisions his program, prioritizing procedures and even calculating the order in which he would use his tools. And he would not get into the water until he was satisfied that the plan accounted for every contingency. He remembered well what happened to soldiers in Vietnam who waited until the action started to think about how to move. In this way, he minimized the need to make decisions underwater, where any number of other factors could thin his judgment. Most of all, Chatterton refused to give up. He began to see that a commercial diver could be a top welder, an expert demolition man, a champion pipe fitter. But if he wasn't compelled by blood and instinct to finish the job, no matter what, he could never be great. No matter what happened every day in commercial diving, and it was for those moments that Chatterton lived. And it occurred to him that it was for those moments that he had been living for a long time. One day, he broke the welding lens in his helmet. Replacing it would hold up the project. He decided to weld without one, eyes closed. A blind welder. The men topside just stared when Chatterton came up with the broken lens and said, "Job's done, fellas." Chatterton drove home grateful that night that he had found a calling, a life's work that allowed him to be excellent again. By 1985, Chatterton had joined the Dock Builders Union, moved to Hackensack, New Jersey, and was earning an excellent salary and benefits as a commercial diver. He dedicated much of his free time to scuba diving off nearby beaches, especially at a nearby Catholic retreat where two small shipwrecks, one steel and one wood, lay in the shallows just a few hundred feet offshore. Chatterton never tired of exploring them. The small wrecks made Chatterton want to see more. He dropped in at a dive shop to inquire about other nearby shipwrecks. A clerk nodded toward a pile of green mimeographed flyers announcing the shop's upcoming charter schedule. Chatterton ran his eyes over the smudged writing,
gulping wondrous names like USS San Diego and Mohawk and Texas Tower. Listed under trips for August was a name that stopped him. Andrea Doria. Chatterton could scarcely believe it.